KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Rebecca Tushnet of Georgetown University Law Center, who is a scholar writing in copyright and trademark in particular, but also the constitutional ramifications of them, as well as several other areas. So I'm very excited to have Rebecca on today. Being as well a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, I became familiar with Rebecca's work through conferences such as the Culture and Environmentalism at 10 conference that Stanford held a few years ago, as well as generally just following the general world of intellectual property scholarship today and where it's leading us. And Rebecca has done some very, very interesting work focusing both in trademark and in copyright. Today, we're going to be discussing a few of her articles of recent vintage and exploring some of the work that she's doing and also tying it into, particularly in the first article, the connection that one might have listening to KZSU, which is that of a music fan. And in particular, what I'm speaking about here is the first article we're going to discuss called Payment and Credit, Copyright Law and Subcultural Creativity, where Rebecca focuses on fan sites and what they mean, the dynamic that fan sites have with respect to copyright law and how copyright law interacts with them. This was an article that was originally published in the Symposium for Cultural Environmentalism at 10, and we're going to spend some time taking a look at it and seeing exactly where copyright law fits into the interesting subculture, or as Rebecca calls it, subcultural creativity that are fan sites. Additionally, we're going to discuss an article that Rebecca had out in the South Carolina Law Review called Trademark Law's Commercial Speech Regulation. We've discussed a fair amount on hearsay culture, the world of trademark, in particular what trademark is and how it fits into the intellectual property regime with people like Professor Eric Goldman and others. And what we're going to be doing today is kind of taking a look at the First Amendment ramifications within trademark law. It's an area within trademark that I think may be a mystery to a lot of people. So I'm excited to explore some of those issues, and particularly how we view issues like confusion in the law when it comes to trademark questions. And then lastly, pending time, we'll discuss an article called Domain and Forum, Public Space, Public Freedom, which appeared recently in Columbia's Journal of Law and the Arts. So Rebecca brings to the show a wealth of scholarship as well as experience in these areas, and so I'm very excited to have her here today. So if I've done my job properly, at the other end of the line is Rebecca. Rebecca, are you there?
Yes, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining the show and for spending your time today with the listeners. Let's start off with just kind of a general background question, which is one that I like to ask all my guests before we get into substance, which is really your background and how you got interested in these particular issues. It's, you know, I think that's one of the fun things about intellectual property law generally, especially today with the advent of of citizen-created media, as it were. And when you talk about this particular area of intellectual property, I guess the follow-up question I would have is, how do you see these issues fitting in more largely, in terms of like a top level, with where intellectual property is headed today?
US since 1978, everything is
And that, you know, it gets us into, you know, the larger question. And, of course, we're, you know, discussing the first article I mentioned, payment and credit, copyright law, and subculture and creativity. I think in order to frame the discussion before we get into these, you know, alternative incentive structures that are increasingly prevalent technologies, perhaps define some terms. For those that aren't familiar, you use the phrase, use the term in the article, fansider and fan vids. What are those?
Well, I define fansite very broadly. Basically, it's someone is a fan of any kind of media production and starts writing about it or putting up pictures or self-created music videos or stories. That's a fansite, and of course, often that will incorporate copyrighted work from the original source, whether it's pictures or video clips or characters, which are also copyrightable under current law. And then fan videos or fan memes are just one variety of that. Now that bandwidth costs have been decreasing and things like Final Cut and Windows Movie Maker are broadly accessible to a portion of the internet or human population, you see lots and lots of people doing
when, to the extent that you have a sense of it, how popular are these sites and how prevalent are they?
Very popular. It's hard to.
Well, I mean, I guess in terms.
More than that, if you do a search for fan fiction and your favorite show on Google, you will probably find hundreds of sites.
Is there a demographic that you think in particular, or, I mean, obviously we can assume that younger people are going out as opposed to older, but is it, I mean, just as anecdata, the classic lawyer just sense of things, but is there any, do you have any sense of whether fan sites are more popular in particular genres or types of media, or is
well,
there any sense of that?
Media fandom is largely female. Often of women in their 20s to their 50s to their 70s. And that group has moved very rapidly to the internet. That media fandom that I'm talking about comes out of science fiction fandom. So there's a heavy basis in traditional science fiction and fantasy work. Harry Potter is, of course, the 800-pound gorilla, and that has brought a lot of young people who are not, who did not come out of traditional media fandom. But there's also this history that really took off with Star Trek and British shows like The Professionals during a same period. So there's a wide variety, I'd say, but
and it seems, I mean, your article mentioned several, you know, somewhat well-known examples that involve Star Trek, and I think you see that generally. I was not quite fan-site stuff, but related are the, you know, Vader sessions and others where people have synced different sound to film in order to make some kind of commentary, perhaps just to be funny. But to start off really the substance of the discussion with that general background, you quoted in the beginning of your article in the introduction a quote from Campbell v. Acuff Rose, which colloquially is known as the Two Live Crew case, and a case that obviously has enormous import in this area of law. And the quote that you pulled from the decision is from Justice Souter, who said, quote, "No man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money." And, you know, that is, you know, a startling statement as well as a good jumping off point to explore the larger intellectual property law issues that you mentioned. What do you take as the import of that quote, and how does it lead you down the analytical path that you took in this article?
Well, first, I should say that I have nothing but respect for that computer for whom I quote, and I think he's a wonderful man.
Fair enough.
Quoting Boswell's Lyndon Johnson.
Right.
So the language is not his own.
That's good. Yes, I should have. You're right. I should have made that point. Correct.
But this is
The
I'm sorry. My work has focused a lot on the people who do things in the non-monetary economy, the gift economy, for
the I think the Two Live Crew case in particular is one that I think is subject to a lot of misunderstanding. Obviously, it being the case that I think in large measure brought a lot of these issues into public eye for you know perhaps the first time. Obviously, not the first case that dealt with it, but given the press that it got, and perhaps it would be useful here for you know the benefit of those that aren't immersed in intellectual property law to. Give like a, you know, almost a, just a very quick précis on what came in terms of views of intellectual property law. What would you say is the main import of that case today? Where has it directed us?
So, Campbell embraced this idea of transformative term popularized by Judge Pierre Lamal of the Second Circuit. Fair use that practically infringes a copyrighted work or would infringe a copyrighted work except for the fact that it's fair use. When you're asking whether something is fair use, the question is the favored uses are those that comment on or transform or criticize or shed new light on the underlying work. So parody would be a classic example of that in the creative field. A book review that quotes several paragraphs of the book or even more would be an example of that in the sort of traditional review that academic analysis of Nietzsche and Hemingway that goes through close analysis of story would be an academic example of that. And Two Live Crew is fun and attractive. Bonding to a work in the same medium that is and also creatively rather than writing an essay about what was going on in Orbison's Christmas or what so Two Live Crew made their own song responding to it and coming out of a musical tradition where that kind of response is much more common. And the court essentially endorsed that. I mean, it's often overlooked that what they did was say that there shouldn't have been summary judgment, there should have been a trial on whether or not this was fair use. And then, of course, the case settled, as most of these cases do. But it's probably remembered more for the principle that transformative pieces are likely to fail.
And I think, and that's where you know we find I think you know the beginning at least of the current view of these kinds of works as being quote unquote okay to use a non-legal term. And oftentimes you hear people, and I actually had on last week John Garin, Dean John Garin from Hamlin, who's written a book taking a very basically oriented towards new business owners on how to use intellectual property. And we had a short discussion about the fact that people tend to think that everything that they do with copyrighted materials that for which they don't get permission could just be called fair use, and that's the end of the analysis. But obviously, it has a lot more contours to it. And so, you know, with that general understanding that's out there, you know, I'm curious to know whether you find or you believe that fair use is, before we get into the issues of how we incentivize creation, that do you think fair use is a concept that's well understood today by, as you talk about it in some of your other articles, the people that are actually deciding what to do with copyright when they're not at work and when they're doing stuff on their own?
Copyright law, because so little of what economically. So, along with asking people to absorb lots of new technology in themselves, how to operate cell phones and how to use the internet to figure out what browser you like and figure out all your passwords and so on, we essentially ask people to add a new legal regime to their set of conscience. And then it's unsurprising that the uptake has been mixed. Now, among fans who are doing creative work, actually, I think we do see more awareness and agency, if only because fans are often challenged to say, why is this okay? What do you do? J.K. Rowling's characters, how dare you write stories with them? And once people start to see that, they think about it and they say, well, I'm not selling this to you for money. That seems important. I'm not claiming to be J.K. Rowling. That also seems important. I'm adding creative labor of my own. That seems important. And therefore, what I'm doing is okay.
And it seems that that's where your article starts entering, I think an interesting area in particular when we talk about why people do what they do. You make a point in your article focusing on the issues of attribution. So what do we mean, first of all, by attribution, and how does that fit into the theory that you're advancing in this article?
Well, what I'm talking about I wanted to distinguish two different ways that you could get payment of some sort, whether monetary or just psychic, for your creative labor. And there's credit being identified as the author or something, or the ultimate source or something. There's compensation getting paid. And there's control getting it to veto potential use. And these days, as individual authors, rarely end up with much in the way of control because you have to surrender various rights. Of course, even J.K. Rowling, who has enormous power, may have trouble getting everything done as he wants it to with the movie because he's licensed the right to make the river work. And people who do not have that amount of creative control, ordinary screenwriters, ordinary authors who sign movies and so on, and certainly people who work in television, have no sort of control. They get plenty of compensation, but they do not get the final say, even though they're popularly identified as the creator, the originator of these characters. So credit, compensation, and control can all be separated, and often are in our current regime. And sometimes, individual authors in particular may prefer credit to other forms of potential compensation. They may want to be identified or they may want to be disidentified. So you may have heard about Alan Moore, right? He doesn't want to be associated with the movie.
Right. I think the listeners and I can understand the nature of the theory. You're not suggesting in the article that the traditional utilitarian theory that exists in copyright and patent and indeed in intellectual property generally, that we reward creation in one form or another, is invalid today. I think rather it's more that there are alternatives that exist.
Absolutely, I've always had that. It's just that when there were fewer ways to distribute anything, it wasn't as noticeable that plenty of people got credit from their friends and neighbors for being good singers, good artists, good storytellers. That was attribution. But because it's circulating much more informally, it was just less noticeable as a part of
How much of the of where we are today do you think, you know, culturally, but more specifically with the law, is directly attributable to the world of sampling, which has been largely killed or certainly limited by strong enforcement of copyright law? What would be, right, and that's also, you know, I think part of, you know, part of the discussion as well, and before we take the break, I guess I'll ask you this question, which is a lot of times you hear the general response, so you start, I'm starting to hear a little bit less, but certainly it's not an argument that has gone the way of the dodo, which basically says, well, you know, the problem that creators have is that they either don't ask for permission or they don't have enough money to pay for the license. Now, it obviously assumes, you know, it assumes the question to begin with, which is whether we should have permission required in the first place. But where do you think, you know, based upon your look at the law, you know, to ask you a largely unfair question, which is not only reading tea leaves but also crystal ball type stuff, where do you see the weight of the argument going at this point? Do you think that the alternative theories of incentives like attribution that you discuss at length in this excellent article are shedding more light in terms of how policymakers view the law, or do you still think if we have a long way to go and we're not anywhere near that?
Right.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the nature of trying to read tea leaves, also, particularly intellectual property, that it's one of those areas that's constantly in a state of flux. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. We're talking with Professor Rebecca Tushnet of Georgetown University Law Center regarding the nature of copyright law with respect to fan sites and generally the incentive structure that exists. We're going to turn after the break to trademark law as well. Before we return to that discussion, though, now's the time on the show where I ask you for money, a tradition that continues literally from the first show of Hearsay Culture, which now, unbelievably, was almost a year and a half ago in May 2006. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you in order to keep its diverse programming going. I should emphasize for those of you listening on the podcast that it is KZSU that affords me the opportunity to air the show. And so therefore, even though you may be listening on the podcast, it's only a slight extension to say that KZSU is a partially responsible party for making sure that Hearsay Culture stays on the air. So if you are interested in listening to KZSU, you can certainly do that by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu and also tuning in the Bay Area at 90.1 FM. But more specifically, what you can do is make a donation. And you can donate to KZSU by going to, again, the website, kzsu.stanford.edu, and clicking on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu. And otherwise, I hope that you do continue to listen to KZSU and hopefully consider making a donation. So we're back with Professor Rebecca Tushnet. And Rebecca, to turn somewhat abruptly to another article that I want to discuss today, an article on trademark laws, commercial speech regulation. I think a good way to dive into this a little bit is really jumping off what I said in the introduction, which is I don't think a lot of people see trademark law and First Amendment jurisprudence as being intertwined. So, you know, for the uninitiated, where is the connection, Primarily?
Well, trademark law regulates the use of words and images, and actually, it's one of the great successes of intellectual property lawyers that they manage to convince people that this somehow has nothing to do with freedom of speech. Libel lawyers thought that that was true in the 1960s, and then they were unpleasantly surprised when the Supreme Court, on a case involving the civil rights protest, said, wait a second, you can't
The yeah, and where we see those connections coming up, especially at least in more publicized cases of documentary filmmakers and people like that who by necessity, in order to expose or just report about a particular issue, have to use trademarks. And you know, it's one of those areas that I think you know, people tend to think of trademarks as merely you know, descriptive marks that companies use to identify their products. But it gets more complicated than that. And I think in your article you start talking about trademark law as commercial speech regulation. How is it that? So what we see there is, I guess, leads us into this issue, which is how do we view the consumer right there? You in your article, you talk about, you know, changing the view that trademark law takes with respect to these issues. So perhaps you can describe that.
Very
do people, in your view trademark as a form of regulation? Or I mean, because it's always one of those questions that I think comes up is how trademark fits into the IP regime generally. And so with your article itself, what are you trying to achieve in terms of pointing out these distinctions? In the remaining, it's a fascinating area, and alas, with a less than 1 hour show, it's difficult to delve into all of the issues, and so I do want to take a few minutes, really, in summing up, to kind of ask you a couple of questions at the top level, which kind of is how I started, which is where... In the scheme of intellectual property, we see, you know, this continual struggle between permissive uses and non-permissive uses. And yet again, here we see in trademark law this issue coming up, and ultimately, as you know, as you talk about it in your article, the question becoming what is the role, particularly of things like the First Amendment. In trademark law and false advertising, or in copyright and fan sites. So I guess, you know, one more crystal ball question, if you'll permit it, is in terms of that dichotomy, and particularly the kinds of new forms of expression that we're seeing across the board, both using copyright materials and trademark materials, do you get the sense that the public, that is, the people that ostensibly would be receiving and benefiting from these new creations, view them as a benefit? What's your, you know, again, just, you know, based upon observation or your sense from, you know, research, not necessarily empirical, of course, but research that you may have done in this, what's your sense of where we are?
There is always where this guy finds out that the girl he had a crush on in high school is has new pictures taken of herself.
Right.
There are these pictures of her in a men's magazine, and he is crushed. And there are always people who react like that to unauthorized interpretations, saying, how dare you destroy what J.K. Rowling has done. I call it the centerfold problem because I don't have much sympathy for that.
That's a good analogy, by the way. I like it.
Because, you know, frankly, the narrator of the song is a real jerk. He has no connection to this woman. He sort of wants her to order herself according to his fantasy life, where only he gets to imagine what she looks like. Naked, still doesn't know her, and still claims that he is the one harmed by whatever she has chosen to do. And there are lots of things you can say about appearing in a men's magazine, but that they harm the guy who had a crush on you doesn't seem
or not to mention, it's probably in the scheme of the potential impacts, it's probably not one that's very high on the list for anyone's concern.
Right. So now, you know, there are people who feel very strongly when their favorite texts get trashed in one way or the other. The thing is that other people's interpretations are rarely the real source of that. So if you think about what's happened to Batman over the past 6 or 7 decades, there have been enormous changes worked on Batman by the owners, and plenty of fans at every point have said Batman is being betrayed, is being destroyed. This is awful. So it's precisely because everyone gets something different out of the text that you get all these different competing interpretations, and then someone always feels like, oh no, the other person got it completely wrong. And, you know, insulting as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's the flip side of the wonder of interpretation is that, you know, there's always going to be someone who says, you got it wrong.
Right.
In the end, I think we're much better off to be able to have these discussions that share our interpretations openly. What the proper interpretation or what possible interpretations ought to be, and express that not just in critical essay formats, but in creative ways too, writing, drawing, making videos.
It's it's really an area that I think warrants a lot more attention, and so I certainly would invite you back on the show to continue the conversation sometime in the future. Before we close, though, you had mentioned to me before we began the show an interesting new project that you're involved in. So perhaps by way of closing, maybe you could talk a little bit about what that project is.
So I'm on the board of a new organization, the Organization for Transformative Work. The website is transformativework.org. And it is going to be a clearing house for fans and for information about creative fan work, both in terms of preserving the history, which stretches back well before the internet, and protecting it in the future by preserving the nonprofit gift economy aspect of it in the face of a lot of attempts to commercialize what they're now calling user-generated content. So there are plenty of commercial enterprises that say, look at all these people doing all this free work. There's got to be a way to monetize that. And you want to preserve the non-commercial aspects of it and the popularly generated rather than carefully channeled and designed to produce profits for somebody else.
Is the organization designed to be to focus on advocacy or
advocacy is the umbrella portion of it, and then we will also have an archive where you can actually find these works. And right now we're in the process.
So the website again?
Transformativeworks.org.
Terrific. Well, Rebecca, I want to thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and discussing.
Thank you very much for having me.
It was terrific, and I will, once the show is posted on hearsayculture.com, I will have a link to the SSRN site where you can find all of Rebecca's articles. So thank you again for joining me today. You've been listening to Hearsay Culture, my interview with Professor Rebecca Tushnet of Georgetown University Law Center. Rebecca's work is really it's really terrific and very broad ranging, and you know, as I mentioned, having a 1 hour show limits the amount of discussion that I could have about all these issues. But I do encourage you to read some of these articles that we were discussing today. The two in particular that we did get to, payment and credit, copyright law, and subcultural creativity, as well as trademark law as commercial speech regulation, both of which you can find on the SSRN.com website. I'm very excited to mention as well that I have a number of interesting guests coming up on Hearsay Culture. Coming up among them is Alex Wright, the author of the book Glut, focusing on information management, as well as David Weinberger, who wrote Everything's Miscellaneous, also taking a look at the nature of information, how information is acquired, and indeed how information is analyzed in today's technological society. I'm also looking forward to a discussion with Eric Davis, who's a return guest on the show, who will be discussing his focus on California mysticism, and particularly how California's culture has contributed to the rise of technology. As well as Kristen Lord, a professor at George Washington University in international politics and in international relations, who's written a book called Perils and Promises, which focuses on transparency and particularly how transparency may or may not make the world safer or not so safe. As a sub-interest of mine is government transparency and particularly its interaction with intellectual property. So I'm looking forward to speaking with Kristen. Also, since the last show, I have confirmed Professor Brett Frischman, who's currently at Loyola University Chicago and visiting at Fordham, who's working on and has been working on really groundbreaking work for the last several years in infrastructure management and the commons, and so he will be on the show as well. And also Professor Ned Snow from University of Arkansas, who's also writing in interest in copyright spheres. So I'm looking forward to having all of these individuals on. As always, Hearsay Culture is a show that welcomes comments and questions and thoughts from its listeners, and particularly I'm always interested in having on a guest that listeners might recommend. And to that end, Michelle Blauwens, who runs the Peer-to-Peer Foundation in Europe, will be on the show sometime in the near future. Michelle particularly was recommended by a listener, and I have, having learned more about his work, I think he's going to be an interesting guest, and so I'm in the process of booking him. So I do encourage you to contact me with other individuals that you think may be good guests for Hearsay Culture. And more specifically, I always welcome your feedback on ways the show can improve, change, and what have you. You can reach me by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And as always, you can access the show several ways. You can get the show live on KZSU by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu or tuning in the Bay Area. Or alternatively, you can get the podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can find the schedule as well as all the previous shows. And I actually crossed the 51st show mark last week. Actually, I'm up to the mid-50s now, but posted is through 51, so I'm excited about that. But you can also get the show by going to the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School by typing Center for Internet Society into the podcast search engine, or through the RSS feed for podcasts through cyberlaw.stanford.edu, cyberlaw.stanford.edu, which is the feed for the Center for Internet Society. So I want to thank you today for listening to Hearsay Culture and my discussion with Professor Rebecca Tushnet of Georgetown University Law Center. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more of its diverse programming, and I will look forward to talking to you next week.